experts in their field, a podcast from the Agricultural Science Association.
Hello, listeners. My name is Niamh Bambrick, and I'm the president of the Agricultural Science Association. In this episode of Experts in Their Field, Council Member Eddie Phelan is joined by Professor John Roach. John is the Chief Science Advisor in the Ministry for Primary Industries in New Zealand and is also the Director of On-Farm Support Services. John talks us through his career to date, from growing up in a farm in Castle Island in County Kerry and then travelling the world, now ending up in New Zealand. John needs no further introduction, so sit back and enjoy this insightful podcast. We'd like to wish John the very best in the future and thank John for his time.
Hi everyone, my name is Eddie Phelan and you're all very welcome to this episode of Experts in Their Field. I'm joined with Professor John Roach. John, thanks for joining us here. Maybe for those that don't know you, can you give a brief overview of your background and career to date, maybe, please?
Absolutely. Well, I'm my current role, I have two roles, I live in New Zealand, Eddie. I'm the Chief Science Advisor at the Ministry for Primary Industries, which is the equivalent of the Department of Ag, Food and the Marine in Ireland. And I'm also the director of the On-Farm Support Service. So we established an advisory service in the ministry 18 months ago. And so I was the establishment director and took on that role full time just before Christmas as well. In New Zealand, we have a tradition of introducing ourselves firstly in Māori, in te reo. So I might do that just to be appropriate from a tikanga perspective. So ko te kai toho toa mātanga pūtai o mātua, me te pau whakaheri ki te mahi aha whanua, ki te manatu aha mātua, ko Crokon tōko manga, ko Mēn tōko awa, ko Norman, ko Celt, ko Irish o ko iwi, ko County Kerry tōko hapu, ko John Roach tōko ingoa. Dea iwa kōrdia, esās erin me, esās kunti ki ri, balia na pel, krina herin me, Sean de Roach te sanam dum. So what that is about, Eddie, very similar to in Ireland, we're defined by where we come from. The Maori introduce their name last. They introduce their mountain first, the mountain that's most specific to their homeland, then the river that flows through it, then quite often the waka, the canoe, the family canoe that brought them to Aotearoa, New Zealand first, and then down to their tribe, their family themselves. And it's just a recognition from that you come from your ancestors, you come from the land that produced you, and you know, the land that dealt your hand, basically. So I grew up in a small, or just outside of a small town in County Kerry, in Central Kerry, called Castle Island. We farmed primarily dairy farm, but we also had sheep, a flock of sheep. My brother had a beef breeder herd, suckler herd, and through university I rented land and we finished forward stores as well. So we've kind of had done our dash through most of the ruminant species. Thankfully pigs were gone off the farm by the time I was born, and so was arable. We were, like everybody else, we were subjected to the government regulations post-World War II that all enterprises, all farms would have a degree of arable. And the person that decided we should have arable in Central Kerry never picked a stone in their life. It wasn't the wisest choice of land use. So thankfully those enterprises had finished by the time I came along.
Yeah. And since then, John, you've been steeped in research, really. I suppose I've come across it a good bit in my own role, but I suppose out of that, look, anything in particular stands out to you or anything of note that you'd like to mention?
Oh, yeah, look, I've been incredibly lucky. My entire life I've met with mentors and people that guided me at the right time of my life, when decisions were coming up, and I was just very, very fortunate. I mean, I did ag science I was intent on doing veterinary medicine, and my father and brother talked me out of it. I think it was the 22nd of January that our CAO forms had to be in. This is all pre-internet, of course, back in 1989. And we sat down the night before, we had to post those, and we talked about what I should do. Deeply interested in agriculture, obviously, was very interested in animal health. And we decided collectively that ag science would be a better opportunity for someone interested in animals, interested in farming, rather than going down that veterinary route. And look, I've never looked back. I think it was the right decision. I've lived the best of both worlds. My research career has centered mainly around metabolic diseases and animal health, particularly through that transition period of calving. And so I've had that opportunity to enjoy both sides. I was again very, very lucky that Miles Rath was my dairy lecturer in university, and I owe Miles a huge debt of gratitude for three reasons, I suppose. Not only did he take the time to suffer the arguments of a young student in his office, and we had many of those, and they were really enlightening for me, but he had the patience to do it. But he also rang me after I left university. I was heading to Chicago to play football. There was a team in Chicago that were willing to pay me to play Gaelic football, and so I was heading there to work construction and play football. And Miles rang me one, I think it was an August afternoon, and told me that there was a master's going in Moorpark, and it was in grazing management, which I had a deep passion for as well. And I kind of told him I wasn't interested. He suggested that I was wrong and that I should really consider this. And anyway, as luck would have it, I did consider it, and I went up and met with Pat Dillon and Seamus Cross at Moorpark. And again, as I said, the rest is history. But the other thing that Miles did for me after 2 years in Moorpark, I was offered a job in Australia with the Department of Ag in Australia as a scientist with a master's degree. And part of the sweetener was that they would allow me to do a PhD. And so, I'd watched enough Home and Away and to want to go and see Australia, I suppose. And yeah, jumped on a plane and got into my head that I wanted to do a PhD in milk fever prevention, particularly in dietary cation anion difference. And had an expert in the University of Melbourne that was also interested as well, but because I wasn't a citizen, it was going to cost, and this is 1996, it was going to cost me $30,000 a year as an international fee-paying student, which was greater than my wage was each year. So
Yeah.
it wasn't a good prospect for me. And I remember I rang Miles one night, and Miles said, "Can you leave it with me for a couple of days?" And he went to, I presume, the Academic Council in UCD. And suggested that if anyone could do this by distance, I could probably do it. And so Miles facilitated me enrolling in UCD for my PhD as well, despite the fact I was living and working in Australia. And I think he probably opened the door for many students that followed me afterwards. But for if it wasn't for people like Miles that saw something in me that they wanted to nurture, Pat Dillon, a fantastic mentor and friend in Moorpark for longer than either of us probably care to remember now,
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't be where I am.
Sure. And John, I suppose looking, I've seen you speak before, but you've farmed, in Ireland, New Zealand, the US and things like that. Over the last number of years, what are the biggest changes you've seen in the industry, or what are the most notable ones that you've seen, I suppose, from your experience?
Oh, that's a look, it's a great question. There's been many of them. It's interesting, Eddie. My father published his memoirs a few years ago, called it's available on Amazon if anybody's interested. It was called Born for Hardship: A Life Through Changing Times. And when I look at the and so he talks about it from his birth year in 1937 all the way through to present day. It was only published a couple of years ago. And from the time where everything was done by horses or by men and women, to the advent of the milking machine and the tractor and everything else entire, The changes he saw in his lifetime make the changes I've seen tiny. But I think the greatest change we witnessed is probably it's a change in societal expectations, and also the recognition that we have an impact beyond our own land, beyond our own farm, that what we do can impact our waterways running through our farms, our aquifers underneath our farms, and therefore waterways a distance away from our farms. And of course, with the advent of the internet, we're drowned in information, starving of knowledge, or the vast majority of the population is. And I think that societal disharmony and the simplicity of really complex situations is something that has created has made life far more difficult. Trying to explain to people that have themselves convinced that they should be one direction, that it might be the wrong direction, when they have a whole litany of information that tells them that they're right, despite the fact that they're not. That's one of the greatest things I've seen. And certainly I'm nearly 6 years in government now as the chief science advisor. And so my role there is to provide free and frank advice to my director general, the CEO of the ministry, and to the ministers that we serve. And a lot of that is making sure that all of our decisions, our communications, our investments are evidence-based, and finding that evidence and cutting through all of that information to find that best evidence while trying to park my own biases is certainly a mission. But I think, look, probably short answer to your question is, I think, when I was growing up, even when I entered university, I specialized in animal production. Shortly after I left university, that became animal science because production became a bad word. At the same time, we had the BSAS, where the British Society, sorry, BSAP, where the British Society of Animal Production changed their name to the British Society of Animal Science. And so we saw this massive shift from production in a continent that had massive stores of food that they were struggling to manage to sell while that food was still edible, through to a strong focus on the environment and people's expectations of what the countryside should look like and how we should farm our land, in that way. I think that's probably the greatest change I've seen in the last 30 years.
Sure. And maybe with that, John, maybe moving to present day and dairying in New Zealand, I suppose what's the lie of the land there at the moment? Is it still as fruitful as ever, or has expansion stopped?
Oh, expansion has stopped, but I mean, you've got to think about it. We've doubled cow numbers in the last 30 years, and that was from an already high base. Like Ireland, like New Zealand, I suppose, Ireland doubled cow numbers in the 1950s. We doubled cow numbers in the 1960s, and we doubled them again in the 1970s, approximately round numbers. And then, of course, our base year for quota came in, and we were stagnant for the better part of 35 years in Ireland. At the same time, New Zealand continued to grow. No subsidization by the government at that stage. The same global economic crisis of the 1980s, obviously, that hit Ireland, and that many of your older and even middle-aged audience will remember. Inflation rates pushing well high into the high double digits. Sorry, the high teens. I mean, sorry, not the high double digits, but and bank interest rates for many with surcharges, etc., in the high 20s. You were exactly the same in New Zealand, but with a global market to contend with and no subsidization by the government. And so the only choice was to get bigger or go home. And that's what's happened to our sheep flocks, our beef stations, and our dairy herds. And then as I suppose the cap reforms of the late 90s, early 2000s led to a little bit more level playing field of the International Trade Organization under the WTO, in the early 2000s, those commodity prices lifted in New Zealand, and that provided a massive impetus to, again, change land use, particularly to dairy. That happened all over the country, but it was particularly evident in the South Island, so particularly evident in Canterbury, Otago, Southland, down the east coast and around the south of the South Island of New Zealand. And of course, that type of land use, you're intensifying stock carrying capacity, you're intensifying inputs. We went from very heavily dry land-based systems to irrigated systems. They were all going to have impacts on the environment. And so by 2015, there was probably a recognition that until we were able to come up with solutions for some of those environmental challenges that we were facing, that the industry wasn't in a position to grow much more. Now, that was on the basis of water. Climate change, greenhouse gas footprint is now another environmental challenge that we're trying to deal with, as is biodiversity. So mirror images of what you're dealing with in Ireland and across Europe, probably with the exception of ammonia, because our systems are all outdoors. We're in a country the size of the United Kingdom with a population the size of Ireland. It's a very different population density of animals and humans. So where ammonia is a greater environmental challenge to you guys and to your partners in Europe, that's something that we're not as concerned about.
Sure. John, we might come back to the environmental discussion in a minute, but I suppose sticking with dairying, if you don't mind, for a second, I suppose at ground level, and because expansion has slowed down maybe a little bit, what are the main focuses of dairy farmers? Is it refining the systems? Is it genetics? What are their main objectives at the minute to, improve profitability and, increase the bottom line?
Yeah, like we've got 11,000 dairy farmers, and I'd say if you asked them that question, you might get 11,000 answers. Again, not dissimilar to Ireland. I look are the same as yourselves. I'm sure our commodity prices are lower than we would like them to be at the moment, and so the particular focus certainly this 12-month period and hopefully the lessons from this 12-month period will continue forward is in cost control and creating that margin per kilo of milk solids within the system. I mean, it's a challenge as we've seen all over the world. The primary measure that a dairy farmer has for success is what did the tanker pick up in the morning, and the volume of milk divided by the number of cows is a metric that we all grew up with. I
Sure.
remember going to the creamery with my old man in the 1970s, and first question after some comment about the weather would be, what did the cows do this morning? And if you said they did 3.5 gallons, you were a good farmer. 4.5 gallons, you were a great farmer. 5.5 gallons, they knew you were telling them lies. So it was and of course it didn't matter because the flow meter was out the front of the creamery anyway, so everyone knew
Yeah.
how much you were producing and what how many cows you were milking. So I think that's an Achilles heel. It's an Achilles heel all over the world, because it doesn't matter where we've analyzed economic databases, milk yield per cow has an extraordinarily poor relationship with profitability. Milk yield per hectare, a slightly better one, but that's generally driven by high milk prices as well. And low milk prices, there's no relationship between milk yield per hectare and profitability. So a lot of the effort by the advisors to the dairy sector over the last 20 years has been on focusing on cost control. So a really strong relationship between milk production, sorry, the price per kilo of milk solids, the cost per kilo of milk solids, and operating profit per hectare, and obviously between operating profit per hectare and return on assets. So that's probably a key focus. It's still a key focus of discussion. We had a pasture summit out here a couple of months ago, which is a kind of a joint conference between Irish and New Zealand farmers every year, swapping over every 2 years. And again, the focus was very heavily on that as to, what are the key metrics that we've got on farm that are associated with profitability. I'd be the first to admit there's no point in being the richest man in the graveyard. You can't take it with you. So you've also got to enjoy what you're doing. So there's got to be some personal goals in that as well. So it's recognizing that. So my advisors, what we're trying to do is sit down with farmers, get their goals. What do they want to achieve from a personal perspective, from a business perspective, and then try and help them achieve that.
Yep. And maybe, John, with that in mind, I suppose, and looking at dairying in New Zealand over the last 20 years, like, is there any, say, two or three takeaways that the Irish dairy industry could learn, say, from its New Zealand counterparts in terms of, what went well, maybe what went not so well, and any key takeaways, I suppose, from your point of view there?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think a key takeaway is in the power of the collective of the farmer coming together with a common problem to find a solution, and working closely with the research and development community to do that. So we have an initiative that's very heavily funded by our ministry called catchment groups, which is groups of farmers, geographically located around a particular catchment of water. That's got a particular problem. Now that could be nitrogen, that could be phosphorus, that could be sediment, and by them coming together with a recognizing that there's a common problem, and a genuine desire to fix it. And let's face it, as I've never been to a country in the world talking to farmers that don't want to leave the land and the environment in a better state than they received it. So that's I think it's a natural collection that comes together. And then, of course, because they're together in that community group, they also identify other challenges that they're facing. That could be greenhouse gas mitigation, it could be adapting to climate change depending on where they're farming, et cetera. So I think that community action for environmental good has been incredibly strong here in New Zealand, and we have some really good examples of it. I'm not aware of the situation in Ireland. You could well have those as well. So, but I haven't been engaged at that level at all. Look, I think partnerships between government and industry have worked really, really well in New Zealand. They're not without their challenges. Both groups are coming with slightly different goals. Well, I'd say the goal is the same, but slightly different drivers in terms of achievement. And so being able to sit down around the table, understand each other's perspectives, and come to a resolution that facilitates a win-win scenario, again, has been a real eye-opener. And I think we've got a couple of good examples of that. We've currently got a public-private partnership called AgriZero here in New Zealand, which it was a joint venture that was set up by our ministry and a group, five large businesses in New Zealand, ruminant agriculture businesses, obviously. And they've put, I think it's probably about $70 or $80 million, with the potential to grow to $100 million a year, into developing solutions, identifying prospective solutions, investing in them, bringing them forward to develop solutions for methane. And look, I'm very, very confident that we will develop those. So I think, just without having thought about it to too great a degree, I think, it's that partnership model that New Zealand was famous for. Ireland also famous for it in terms of our cooperative structures back from the 1950s in particular. But also, the borrowing of the discussion group, and the purchasing group that was a New Zealand phenomenon, really, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and came into Ireland at that stage, and really became a force to be reckoned with in terms of moving the dial on farm practices and farm improvement.
One you would have mentioned as well, John, at the ASA conference you spoke at, I noted it at the time. He Waka Eka Noa was one between the Maoris, the government, and the farmers as well. But interesting to see, like, is there buy-in from from farmers and industry there? Are both work, tending to work together, or I suppose one thing we not necessarily struggle with here is just bringing, the farming sector along in the masses, not only within the dairy sector, but between dairy, beef, sheep, pig, poultry, tillage, getting the entire farming sector moving into one direction. But Is that working in New Zealand? Is it possible? Is it being achieved? You're obviously in the front line there, working with the ministry. So I suppose, how are you negotiating that path?
Yeah, like it's a good one. So He Waka Eke Noa is the Maori for we're all in the same canoe. So we're all in this together is what He Waka Eke Noa stands for. And it was a partnership, as you said, between iwi, Maori government and industry. And it had some successes. Now we've obviously recently had an election, so we've got a new government, and we're still awaiting where we're going to go in terms of those government industry working together groups. So He Waka Eke Noa didn't quite land. There was a lot of good work that was undertaken, a lot of really good work undertaken. But there's a general agreement. So certainly not among all farmers. I mean, farmers are a very heterogeneous group of people, just like every other community. And we've got groups of farmers that are leading in this way, recognize that the market is demanding this. And that if we're to have a market for our products in a decade or longer, then we have to meet those market expectations. And at the other end of the bell curve, we have groups of farmers that don't believe that climate change is real, and so don't believe that there's any reason to do anything. So there is a very, very heterogeneous mix there. So I don't ever hope that w in any community, whether that's farming or an urban community, that we will get everybody under the same umbrella to say, we've all got to row the canoe this way. But I do, there is a strong sense of a need for action among the decision makers in the industry groups. And they've, as I said, with AgriZero, they've put their money where their mouth is. There is a strong acknowledgement of a need for action among our government and among iwi. So, that, and as I mentioned earlier, I think, it's that common goal that will usually win out in the actions that need to be had. But remember, with methane, we're battling 50 to 70 million years of evolution. You pick a number somewhere in that range. This is something that ruminant animals have been doing for a long time, despite the fact it wastes between 10 and 20% of the energy they consume. So from an evolutionary point of view, it doesn't make sense that an animal will continue to do things that waste that amount of energy, unless it was absolutely fundamentally important to what they're doing. The easiest way of getting rid of hydrogen ions in the rumen, as you'd know, Eddie. But we also know that not every animal does it to the same extent. There's a good genetic variation there. There's a relatively strong heritability there. So the animal doesn't need to do it, but as a species or as a series of species, they have chosen to do it. So I think there's a good agreement that we need change. There's a good agreement that we need market expectations. There's also a recognition that we need the time to develop the solutions. So, I mean, telling people they have to do something if they don't have solutions is not a really
Sure.
pragmatic way of solving any problem.
John, probably here in Ireland at the moment, water quality, greenhouse gas emissions, and biodiversity are probably close to the top three of, what we need to tackle at the moment. Is it similar in New Zealand at the moment? And what are farmers what steps are farmers taking to overcome these?
Yeah, look, I think from an environmental point of view, absolutely, there would be the top three, and but certainly your greenhouse gases being a global problem at an atmospheric level. I mean, that's a nationwide problem. Your water quality, that will very much depend on where you are in the country, as it is in Ireland. You've got catchments within Ireland that you'd be far more
Sure.
concerned about than others as well. And then once you've identified your catchments of concern, what is the key contributing factor? Is that nitrogen, phosphorus, E. coli, sediment? And because that will obviously drive what are your potential solutions. So, and then biodiversity. Now, as I said, we're fortunate in New Zealand that, we're a very large landmass. We're the size of the United Kingdom, with a population the size of Ireland. And so we have large areas of crown-controlled biodiversity all over the country. We're particularly fortunate with that. But even with that, there's a recognition by the purchasers of our goods, by our markets, that they want to see us to be proactive in biodiversity on our farms. Now, whether that's functionally diverse pastures that encourage pollinators through our pastures, or it's bee corridors across productive landscapes. They're all topics of conversations for us. And we came up with the concept of regenerating Aotearoa. So Aotearoa is the Maori word for New Zealand, the land of the long white cloud. And it was taking the concept of regenerative agriculture, which has come out of North America, Africa, Australia, degraded arable systems, really, rather than the vast majority of our agricultural land is under pastoral ag. So most of the recommendations weren't appropriate. So, but what was enticing about it was an outcome-based philosophy. So it wasn't an input-based philosophy, thou shalt not do this. It was, we want to achieve this. And so we came up with a vision that acknowledged that any practices, any farm practices that end up achieving improvements in freshwater quality, biodiversity, animal welfare, reducing our greenhouse gas footprint, and improving the value to farmers, that should be regarded as a regenerative practice. And as we look at it, and as I look at the marketing strategies of some of the bigger companies around the world and their view of regenerative agriculture, our vision fits in very, very well for them. So what we're trying to do is capture that into an integrated approach to farm planning, rather than we deal with water now, and then tomorrow I'll come back to you and I'll deal with greenhouse gases, and then tomorrow I'll come back to you and deal with biodiversity. These things are intertwined. So why can't we have that conversation with farmers now? Because, and again, look, my father took out a lot of trees out of our farm, but I can guarantee you he planted a heck of a lot more trees than he took out. He just took them out of places and he put them into other places. And I think we're heading fast towards 10 billion people. We have to produce as much protein in the next 30 years as we did in the last 2,000 years. So we still need productive agricultural landscapes to produce high quality food with a low carbon, low contaminant load footprint to those. But we've also got to protect nature. And I don't think there's any, well, certainly I've never come across a farmer that would disagree with that. It's how we go about it and how we go about doing those things together that is generally the cause for debate. And I think that debate is very healthy. But let's have the debate in that healthy, open fashion, rather than taking encampments that fight each other, like we used to do in the old days of hurling and football.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you there. It's improving 100 things by 1% rather than one thing by 100%. And I think, the wider industry does need to be involved in it and, come together as well with it.
The
John, I
farmer
suppose
must
just.
be at the center. Sorry, Eddie. The farmer must be at the center of our solutions. So they've got to be involved in that. Otherwise, you're imposing it on them. And the vast majority of the democratic countries, it is really difficult to impose your will on a group of people. They've got to come along for the journey. They've got to believe. So it's got to be explained as to why this is important. What difference will this make? What difference will this practice change make to the thing that we're trying to achieve? So it is a journey, but to be honest, I feel very fortunate to be involved, to have the opportunity to develop the team that I've developed up here, and have a bunch of people that genuinely want to engage with farmers, to help farmers achieve what needs to be achieved. Look, I'm really excited by that part of my role.
Sure. And John, without getting into too much detail, but maybe if you could give us some idea of, how's that being rolled out, what kind of targets are set, and what kind of time frames have you set on reaching those targets if possible? I suppose in Ireland, a lot of it's driven through Teagasc and the Signpost Programme, and then the co-ops have their own programs and incentivize that too, and that's working very well. But just to be good to get, I suppose, the on the ground view of what's happening in New Zealand there.
Absolutely. Look, we've got very similar. In fact, I suppose imitation is the greatest form of flattery. We're looking at how Ireland is doing this and doing this well as well. So the Signpost Programme, I think, is a great initiative by Teagasc, and in a lot of ways on-farm support. will mimic that. It's on a much smaller scale, so we will try and have our effect through influencing others and try and through connecting with the service agencies that are already out there. Again, because of the commercial model in New Zealand, we have a far greater private advisory network in New Zealand than you do in Ireland, and probably a much smaller public one in terms of what you've got through Teagasc. A huge chunk of our role will be trying to identify where are the gaps, how are we working, are all the different interests working, for example, in the water quality space, in the different regions, in the different catchments, what's being done, and through that do a gap analysis as to what isn't being done, and then try and fill that gap with our investment, etc. So it's similar. Our milk companies, our meat companies, have varying degrees of those incentive programs as well. I mean, Fonterra has a cooperative difference where they pay farmers a premium for meeting certain goals. Synlait, as a milk company, has a Lead with Pride program, which similarly has that incentivized program. And I see the same developing in Ireland. So I think it's very, very similar. What I don't have an opportunity to talk to you about now is from a regulatory perspective, from a government perspective, because as I said, we've just got a new government elected, and they've literally just got their feet under the table, and we're just starting to have those conversations as to what are those targets and how are we going to achieve them, how are we going to best influence the achievement of those targets. But there's certainly a commitment by the government to meeting our international obligations around climate change, etc.
Yep. And staying on that, John, like public perception at the moment of agriculture in New Zealand, what's the view from the public and the general public? Are they still on board with it, or is there, I suppose, what's the feeling on the ground there,
Yeah, like it's a good question. As a scientist, I'd like to be quantitative for you on this, and it's really hard to be, Eddie. It's we have the same noisy headlines, we have the same noisy articles as you do. We have billboards, but probably not to the same extent as you see them across Ireland in terms of anti-animal farming. But whenever I've seen anyone look at this from a scientific, take a scientific approach to this, urban people have a deep respect for farmers and for farming. They understand that the food doesn't come out of a fridge, that there's people working hard to produce high quality food for them. Unfortunately, we are dealing with generations that are now one or two generations removed from farming, so they have no practical understanding of or a less of a practical understanding of what happened in farming compared with kids growing up in cities in the 1960s, 1970s, often spent time with relatives on the farm during summer holidays, things like that. So that's less. So just so if you were to have not look into this, you would possibly convinced that there's an urban-rural divide in terms of what needs to happen. I don't think that's true. The scientific evidence that I've seen wouldn't support that. It would support the fact that urban people living in cities have a deep respect for farmers and a deep respect for farming, but that we could do better. That there are animal welfare challenges that we need to address. That there are water quality challenges that we need to address, that there are greenhouse gas footprint challenges that we need to address. But that said, they also recognize that farming isn't easy. It's hard work, long hours. Farmers aren't rolling in money, so it takes money to make some of these changes as well. So I think it's balanced. But again, to give you an example, I don't know if this has been repeated. I haven't seen it repeated, but Dairy NZ, as the industry levy organization here in New Zealand, did a survey of Aucklanders. It might be 10 or 11 years ago, I can't remember exactly. And they found, I think it was around 65 or 70% of Aucklanders never remembered reading a bad news story about dairy farming. I mean, at the time, every dairy farmer would have thought that everyone in Auckland hated them because of the bad news stories. And so those stories get put out there. Those of us involved in agriculture read them. They infuriate us, so we read them a second time to make sure that we got them absolutely right. And then we rant and rave for quite some time about these people that just don't understand us. I think we pay too much heed to that squeaky wheel that is a very small part of the population of our urban centers. There was a, someone once told me, someone wise once told me that a lion doesn't lose sleep over the opinions of sheep. And I think we should bank that at times, that let them think what we want or what they want. We'll just continue to get better. And you know, there was a, I remember reading a saying in the United States on a visit 20 or more years ago. It was over the door of a meeting room in Washington, D.C., and it said, if the cities fell tomorrow, agriculture would continue. But if agriculture stopped tomorrow, the cities would fall. And I think, you know, that context is alive and well. 80% of the income coming into New Zealand comes in through the primary sector, comes in through ag, through hort, through fisheries and through forestry. And so there's a strong recognition as to the importance of our primary sector here to what we all take for granted as a civilized country.
Yep. No, it's great to hear. Yeah, it's really great to hear. Maybe John, just changing tact a little bit, bringing it back to the current state of play here in Ireland at the moment. I suppose we're coming on out of the back of a tough 2023. Dairy farm profits are down, as we've seen from the latest Profit Monitor results coming back. But I suppose, you know, the other side of the thing is we're dealing with derogation and banding as well. But you've spoken a lot in the past about marginal milk, and I suppose looking at it in terms of, well, derogation and banding is coming into play, but guys are also thinking about increasing litres and increasing production to maintain farm profitability. Do you mind comment on that? And, you know, maybe first in terms of what marginal milk is and taking it from there, if you wouldn't mind.
Look, happy to, Eddie. I remember I spoke, I think it was at the, I think it might have been at the Irish Grassland Association in December, or sorry, in January of 2015, just before quotas went in April. And one of my key messages was, look, when quotas go, you can produce more milk. That doesn't mean you should produce more milk. You need to look at your business model, and particularly your business goals. Actually, I don't know if I told a story at that stage, but you know, you mentioned earlier that we were farming in the United States, and learned a huge amount in that process. You know, I was young enough to think I knew everything when we went in there, and it was amazing how much I learned in the space of a couple of years. But after that learning experience, I got the opportunity. I was working with a private equity firm out of Chicago, and they were interested in setting up a farming business, a dairy farming business in the Midwest, and they wanted it at scale. So they wanted a 70,000 cow business, 100, 700 cow units. And so I did the business plan for them. I did the prospectus, and I said, look, we can do this in 7 to 10 years. And their funding cycle was shorter than that. They needed it done in 5 years. And I said, well, I can't do that. I can't do it, because the minute I step in to buy that volume of land, I'm going to try to drive the price of land through the roof. It just wouldn't work in that time scale. So
Sure.
we bought the company. But at the time, I remember talking with a group of farmers in Ireland, and my father was with me. And they asked, you know, what was I doing now? And I said, look, I'm setting up this seven. I'm sorry, I'm looking at setting up this 70,000 cow business. And you could see eyes open wide, the size of this business. And as I look back in it, it was a huge undertaking if we were to go ahead. And I remember sitting into the car with my father afterwards. And just to give you the picture, you know, I was just clicking my belt, I was driving, and you know the way you can almost feel someone looking at you when they're looking at you. And I looked up, and he was staring at me, and he said to me, he said, you know, you've only one family to feed. How many cows do you need to milk? And I think it was a salient point for me. Probably took me another couple of years to really understand what he meant by that. But it was the case of, you know, there's no point in being the richest man in the graveyard, and there's certainly no point in reaching that point alone. So you've got to have personal goals, and decide what are those personal goals, and then how much money do you need for those personal goals, and set your business up to be in that state. And that was the concept of marginal milk was alien to me at that stage when I had that conversation. But We had a couple of downturns, obviously with the world financial crisis, and then we had the 14, 15, 16 downturn in milk price as well. And we headed into the same situation as you're describing, and that we're just suffering in New Zealand at the moment as well. And we had spent 10 years telling farmers that using supplements wasn't profitable. And we were telling that to farmers that were paying tax, using supplements and paying tax. So they knew they were profitable, and they therefore knew we didn't know what we were talking about. And we didn't. We were actually talking about a system rather than talking about a component of a system, which was the point at which you were using supplements to increase your stocking rate. So marginal milk, to define it, is it's you change something in your business to produce more milk. That additional milk is marginal milk relative to what you were doing. So if you're milking, actually, and it goes the other way as well, if you're milking twice a day and you decide you want to go milking once a day, you will produce less milk per hectare. There's no question about that. That reduction in milk is the marginal milk you got from milking twice a day. Now, there are cost savings to doing that, as well as reductions in revenue. So for some people, that might be the right thing to do. I'm not saying it isn't, but that's marginal milk from twice a day. If you're stocked at 1.5 cows per hectare, and you decide to put in another 500 kilos of supplement a cow to bump it up to 1.7 cows per hectare, then that milk you're getting from the extra 0.2 cows per hectare and the 500 kilos of supplements is what I'm terming marginal milk. So marginal economics is a well-known branch of microeconomics, and it's unfortunately, it's usually badly taught. In my opinion, it's usually badly taught. I'm self-informed on this. Don't regard myself as an expert in any way, but generally speaking, what we talk about is that if you increase your production, you'll dilute your fixed costs, and therefore your business will be better as a result. So if you produce more milk, then the overhead costs, your own wage, whoever's working with you, the capital infrastructure, the repairs and maintenance will all be diluted. And George Ramsbottom published a paper in 2015 with myself and Brendan Horne and Donna Berry, I think it was. And it was where a massive penny dropped for me that there is almost no fixed costs in our business. Interest paid, as long as you're on fixed interest rates, is a fixed cost. There's no question about that. So if you produce more milk, you'll dilute your interest bill per kilo of milk solids, no question. But virtually every other cost that we call fixed increases as we intensify a system. So your electricity cost goes up because you produce more milk. The milking machine is on for longer. You're cooling more milk. The ice bank is working harder. So, yes, your line charge remains the same, but your electricity cost goes up. So virtually every one of our fixed costs is actually what I call a mixed cost. It's a mixed of small amount of variable, a small amount of fixed, and the rest of it is variable. And so George is, if any of you haven't read that paper, 2015 Journal of Dairy Science, well worth a read. It was a penny dropping moment for me, certainly. And I saw the same back here in New Zealand. So for every 1 euro an Irish farmer spent on feed, their total cost went up 1.53 euro. Their variable costs, which would have been the ones we fixated on, the feed costs, the feeding costs, went up 20 cents, about 20 cents, 22 cents, something like that, and their fixed costs went up an equivalent amount to make that up. We see exactly the same here in New Zealand. Saw exactly the same in the UK. I analysed the UK national database, and for every pound an English farmer spent on, actually it was a UK farmer, it was across the three countries. Northern Ireland wasn't included in that. For every pound they spent on feed, their total cost went up £1.60. So it was extraordinary. And so what that allowed us to do then was there was an experiment undertaken in New Zealand in the 1990s, if you believe, and we went back and we reanalyzed it and published it in the Journal of Dairy Science in 2017. Kevin MacDonald is the lead author on that, but I did the marginal economics analysis on that. And what it showed was that if you set your stocking rate for your farm to optimize the management of your farm heavily based on pasture, putting in feed to buffer the shoulders was economic. Even even at moderate milk prices and moderate supplement prices, it was economic. However, putting in feed to drive up stocking rate was only profitable at the highest possible milk price and the lowest possible supplement price at the same time. So if you had the highest possible milk price and a high supplement price, it wasn't going to benefit. And if you had a low supplement price but a low milk price, you weren't going to benefit economically. And so that's I can't answer the question fundamentally for every farmer in a general comment. But what I'd ask them to think about is what is the stocking rate that you can carry with 500 kilos of supplement a cow? Once you start going above that and bringing feed in, you're paying for every bit of milk you're producing from that supplement. And generally speaking, the bottom end of the bell curve of your herd isn't worth feeding that to. So rather than bringing in that feed and bumping up your numbers, you'd be better off actually getting rid of the bottom 5, 10% on a milk production basis. Despite the fact they're pregnant, because they'll get pregnant by looking at them, they're producing more milk. They're what the farmers in the 1920s used to call border cows. They weren't producing enough to pay for their board, their border cows.
Yeah.
So I think that to me, it's not, maybe it's something that we do at another podcast, Eddie, to have a longer conversation about that. But it doesn't matter where I've gone, and that's really interesting in itself. You know, when you think about from farming in the UK with the mixture of systems to farming in Ireland, to farming in the United States, to farming in Australia, to farming in New Zealand, we find this constant relationship between intensification from a supplementation point of view and operating costs. It's not saying no supplements. That's not what I don't want anyone taking that message away. It's actually the point at which you are increasing your stocking rate by bringing in supplements. You're increasing your stocking rate by renting land to grow silage to bring it in. There's a point there where you're working harder to make other people money.
Yep. No, it's look, John, we could chat for a lot longer on that in itself. It's something that's been thrown around a lot now, the fact that, a lot of guys are restricted with banding and derogation and even land availability. So, system drift, marginal milk, a lot of those terms are being thrown around, but it is up for debate, and we might look at having another conversation on it. John, before we maybe try draw things to a close, I suppose you mentioned the global dairy market, or the global demand for protein is increasing. The population in Africa is set to double by 2050. How is the dairy industry going to tackle that, or how is it going to meet that demand? Given what's happening in Ireland, the Netherlands, across Europe, and things like that, where is that extra protein going to come from, to meet that kind of demand, not only in Africa, across the world?
Oh, look, that's a great question, Eddie, and I will put my hand in my heart and say I'm not a futurist, so don't take this as having any insight into the future. Look, there's the interesting thing is that is a requirement for protein, not just a requirement for food, not just a requirement for calories. If it was a requirement for calories, then we're probably producing close to enough anyway, through certain crops. But it's the fact that it's protein, and so I think it will take a lot of ingenuity. I mean, a lot of that will come from animal protein. There's no question about it. But what you'll see is probably a greater dispersal of animal protein becoming a smaller part of every meal, but of a greater number of meals, and plant-based proteins becoming a constituent of a lot more meals than they are now. And I don't take that as a negativity. I don't think that's a threat. Plant-based proteins are by and largely produced by farmers as well. They're produced by our arable colleagues, producing oil seeds and other things like that. But I think there's initiatives. We're currently funding a program here with a company called LEAFT in New Zealand. And I know you've got similar initiatives happening in Ireland with the extraction of the protein from ryegrass or lucerne before we actually feed the ryegrass or lucerne to the animals. And of course, that is a win-win-win situation. Our nitrogen contaminant loss to waterways is primarily driven by urine patches from animals that have eaten too much protein in their grass. So if we could take that surplus protein out, and it's a really high quality food, let's not mince our words on that, and then feed a lower protein grass to our cows, we could have a plant-based protein and an animal-based protein coming from our farming businesses. There's no question about it. We will see genetic technologies, see the development of lab-based plant-based foods being produced, or lab-based animal-based foods being produced. Will they replace our animal-based proteins? I don't think they'll replace them. I think they'll add to them. So, we now have the technologies for the production of whey-based proteins in fermentation vats. There's a number of companies around the world perfecting that, and other micro constituents like lactoferrin and probably other small proteins. And so what that will allow us to do is fortify foods with those types of proteins. They won't replace the protein we're producing. They'll fortify the foods that we're producing. So I often finish my presentations talking to farmers here about the future of food with what we've got to recognize that we produce high quality food. So, trained as a nutritionist like yourself, Eddie, the best piece of nutrition advice I was ever given was you stick to the outside aisle of the supermarket. You avoid the inside aisles. So if you think about it from your local supermarket, my local supermarket down the road here, you walk through the door, you got your fresh fruit and veggies, you walk past the deli, the red meat section, the chicken, the fish, down past the ice cream, into the dairy section, the fermented meats, the cheeses, the yogurts, etc., and you end in the alcohol corner at the end. You got a perfectly balanced diet on the outside aisle of the supermarket. We produce the outside aisle of the supermarket. We don't produce the inside aisles. That's the multinationals that take grains and they turn them into products that people want to eat, and they don't have that balanced nourishment that comes with the outside aisle of the supermarket. So we produce that outside aisle. That outside aisle is always going to be wanted. So I don't take those other things as a threat. However, they will become a threat if we don't deliver to consumers what they demand of us. And that is a high quality product at a price they can afford with an environmental footprint that is leaving a better world for their children and grandchildren than we're currently in. And I think we can do that. This is a win-win-win. I would just say, get up in the morning and go, how am I going to meet that challenge?
Sure. Couldn't agree more. John, just before one last thing before we wrap things up, a lot of our audience is current ag science students, current college students that'll be graduating in May and in the years to come as well. A John Roach that's graduating next May in 2024, what piece of advice would you have for that person heading out into the ag industry, whether it be farming or into industry itself?
Yeah, look, as well as what I just told you, that we've got a bright future, that ag science graduates are going to be probably some of the most important, are actually going to be the most important graduates for the future of the world. So, again, badge of honor, wear that. You don't have to tell everybody that because you're skiting. The people that are producing silicon chips and the computer science people will think that artificial intelligence is going to be the most important thing in the world. And it'll be important, but I've never eaten a silicon chip, but I doubt if it's that tasty. So just remember that. But look, if I could go back, I think the one thing I would probably do more of, I was fortunate, like I said at the start, I got really, really influential, really good people that saw something in me that were willing to spend their time. There's probably a number of the farmers that are listening that will recognize themselves even in that. A bunch of farmers here in New Zealand, that have given me a lot of time over the years to educate me. You know, Einstein said that education is what is left when you've forgotten everything that you learned in school. You know, you're coming out with a degree, you've coming out with skills that you've developed in university, then your education really starts. So find mentors, you know, find people that you know, they're broad-minded people. They see a bright future for agriculture. They see a bright future for food production. They see a bright future in you. Stay away from negative people. They will deliver nothing to you. Listen to them because everybody's perspective is important, but don't spend the amount of time you would spend with positive future-looking people. I was asked a question actually at that Irish Grassland Association conference that if I could go back 20 years, you know, what would I say to my younger self back then? And my answer was, listen to your father a little bit more. Because at the age of 20, I thought the man knew nothing. By the time I was 40, I was amazed how much he had learned in 20 years. And I think that was probably, you know, it's a fault of youth. You know, you've got enthusiasm, you want these old people to get out of your way. Those old people have learned a lot. I'm not saying you need to listen to or agree with everything they've said, but you will get a lot of value out of people that see value in you and are prepared to spend time telling you about things that you may not have considered.
Yep. Couldn't agree more with you, John, on that. Look, with that, we might draw this conversation to a close. John, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciated some great insights provided there and some great advice also. So really appreciate that. And look, hopefully we might catch up again someday. John, thank you. Cheers.
Thanks, Eddie. See you.